Let's move on, because there was other incredible evidence yesterday at the RHI inquiry. So let's turn now to Arlene Foster's former special advisor, Dr. Andrew Crawford. So what do we know about him so far? As I mentioned earlier, there was a £100,000 report that you, the public, paid for. The evidence ranges from he didn't read it to he scantily read it. He certainly didn't see any of the detail within it. He is the same special advisor who is now currently employed by the DUP. And yesterday, and Sam, we'll get your reaction to this, Dr. Crawford has now hit out at some of the civil servants who were working in the department, and he has accused some of them of deliberately misleading Arlene Foster, which is a huge claim, something that no doubt those civil servants would vehemently deny. The claim was made just after the Inquiry Counsel, Joseph Aiken, asked Dr. Crawford if he was suggesting that officials had misrepresented the content of a report to the minister. Let's have a listen.
You could go a step further and say the officials were deliberately misleading the minister on this particular point. Look, I said from day one, the submissions are the bedrock of how we made our decisions. The minister signed off a number of times in this direction of travel. Not only that, the minister then sent a letter to her executive colleagues. The minister also sent a letter to the ETI committee, who have a job to scrutinise this. And what she sent to them was not of an accurate reflection of what officials knew. Now, that is very grave, very severe. Now, I don't know what the outworking would have been, but the minister would not have been happy. And this would have been, I can't say what the ramifications would have been, but certainly the minister would not have trust in one of her key officials if we had picked this up. And trust is critical in this whole, you know, that between the minister and her key officials. If there's a breakdown of trust, you know, that's not a territory you want to get into.
This is a functioning department, one of the departments in the executive that is supposed to be governing Northern Ireland. Why would officials in that department deliberately mislead a minister?
Well, I can't answer that. That is a question for the people who put the papers up to the minister. I don't know whether it was a matter of they had done significant amount of work and there's a direction of travel they didn't want to turn away from. I don't know whether they were concerned that the minister would want to bring in a capital grant scheme and that would bring then additional pressures on the department or the division. I can't answer why they done what they done, but I have no other explanation as to why there was not greater clarity in the various documents that came up to the minister along the way. And it's not even that. You know, the minister sent a letter to the ETI committee. The SEPA report should have been included to allow them to help to scrutinise us. You know, so not only could I have picked it up, but the scrutiny committee could have picked it up. You know, so there were a number of other things that could and should have happened that didn't happen. And it's with hindsight that we can identify the problem, but I can't identify why that problem occurred, why they didn't put up submissions that give greater clarity. Because one of the conclusions out of all of this, the minister could say it, well, I'm looking at all of the options, but we will continue with a Northern Ireland RHI because of the wider benefits and all the rest of it. Unlikely with the cost differential, but that could have been one of the outcomes. But it was only right for the officials to put that up in a submission to the minister so she could look at the various options again, even if it was late in the day, and say, right, let's agree with this, and should have asked for additional paperwork to justify why she was agreeing with that particular option or to look at one of the other options.
And Sam, we're playing that fuller excerpt, so we're being fair to Dr. Crawford. But the top line within that is that he is now accusing officials of deliberately misleading Arlene Foster. Now, the context around that, a scheme which went on to provide for a political crisis that contributed to the government falling in Northern Ireland. The man still working within the DUP, close advisor to Arlene Foster, believes that she was deliberately misled. That's a huge claim to make, Sam.
It's a massive claim. I think, as we were talking about earlier, it's certainly the case that these documents were, in several cases, deeply misleading. Nobody looking at them now with a fair mind could say anything other than that, and the civil service have accepted that. But Dr. Crawford is going beyond that and saying that the motive behind that inaccuracy or that misleading information that was put before the minister was that it was intended to mislead. Now, that's a very significant thing to say. It's very difficult to prove motive. You heard him there. He was initially saying, I can't answer that as to why they would have done that. He then went on to almost suggest that they didn't want to do more work, and that was what it might have lain behind it, but there was no real evidence as to that being the case. I think that certainly, I mean, I suppose it fits into a wider debate as to whether this was cock-up or more conspiratorial, but I mean, it's certainly a huge claim for a minister or a special advisor, in this case a special advisor, to claim that their own officials are deliberately misleading them.
Because there are lots of questions follow from that, and we stressed this morning that those officials would vehemently deny that they deliberately misled anybody. And Dr. Crawford, who is making this claim, is the same man who inappropriately tipped off his relatives about the scheme. But Sam, you then start getting into the what ifs. So if Dr. Crawford, a significant figure in Northern Irish politics, is right, then the question follows, who? Who deliberately misled the minister that led to one of the biggest political crises in Northern Ireland? And if it's not true, why is he saying it? Why is he heading out at officials who work within that department?
I think we obviously can't prove whether what he's saying is accurate or not accurate. That will be something which the inquiry will tease out, will ultimately come with a finding on. But I think what this does point to is the level of the breakdown within devolution. This was a system which, from the outside, we all knew had difficulties. It was broken in some ways. We didn't have a clue as to how deeply broken it was inside. You have a situation here where officials are giving inaccurate information to the minister. The minister is signing something which she really doesn't have any basis for signing. You have a situation now where her key advisor is saying that those people were deliberately trying to and give her inaccurate information. I mean, it's just an extraordinary picture of a broken system within government in Stormont and in Northern Ireland.
The inquiry chair, Sir Patrick Coughlan, then asked if it was the case that officials had deliberately misled the minister, then that must mean, he said, the department was broken. Let's have a listen.
If either of those concerns, the extra work or the stage to which they had arrived at, were the concerns that were driving officials to deliberately mislead the minister, this was a broken department, wasn't it?
Not a broken department.
But if that's how they felt.
Well, I can't answer for them. That is a question for the key officials.
I know you can't, but if that is how they felt, that, look, we've done so much work, the challenge fund will mean more work, we have no alternative here but to deliberately mislead the minister. If that was the way in which officials had come to regard their minister and their duties towards her, why would you disagree with the description that the department was broken?
Because I've said before, there are many, many issues of grave importance going through the department at this particular time. The department delivered a lot. In terms of this particular issue, I can't answer why officials did not give greater clarity in the submissions that came up to the minister. But it's wrong to damn the whole department and what was going on in it. The minister, if instead of the submission come up for formal consultation, I believe if a submission came up to the minister and said, look here, we've got this final report, here are the problems with it, the minister would be more than happy to say, right, let's park it, I'll speak to the ETI committee chair, I'll speak to my executive colleagues. An executive meeting was taking place every other Thursday. It was a matter of putting any other business on the agenda. The minister would have said, I sent you a letter to do with the renewable heat scheme. I have additional information. I'm going to have to come back to you on that. There's more important issues here that it's only come to my light. You know, it's not a matter that the minister has said, no, you have to continue on. I can't answer why the officials took the direction of travel they can, but it is wrong to say that the department was broken.
Sam, I think one of the valid questions as we all listen to this together is that if devolution was to be restored, are they capable? Are they actually capable of running Northern Ireland when you look at what has happened here? Civil servants misinterpreting things, giving the minister information that was at best misleading. Special advisers not reading 100 grand reports. Minister signing off that she's satisfied that the benefits essentially outweigh the costs when she doesn't know what the costs are. The key phrase is, I'm satisfied the benefits justify the costs, is what Arlene Foster signed. Are we capable of devolution in Northern Ireland?
You heard in Sir Patrick Coughlin's voice there just incredulity. This is a judge who has who's very experienced. He's now retired. He sat in the High Court, in the Court of Appeal, and he's heard all sorts of cases about all sorts of things. Time and time again, you see him with incredulity written all over his face and in his voice as he hears some of this evidence. I think that there are two questions, I suppose. There's a question of the capability of these politicians and advisers, and then there's the question, and of the civil service, and then there's the question of the systems whereby they are operating. Some of those clearly are broken, but I mean, there's clearly a breakdown here. Andrew Crawford is trying to say that was limited to the energy division within DEDI, that it didn't extend beyond that. I think the scale and the multiple nature of the failures here is really such that it would be surprising if it never happened anywhere else in the department.
And this goes, and just to repeat, this goes beyond Arlene Foster or Dr. Crawford, because there were scrutiny committees, there were people from other political parties who maybe should have been asking more questions. They themselves maybe should have been saying, how much is that scheme going to cost? The whole system of government is set up with checks and balances throughout it, and yet this scheme, where nobody knew how much it was actually going to cost, got through.
That's right, and I think, I mean, the massive failure here, I think, is by the department. Whether you split that between the minister and her SPAD or her officials, however you break that down, I think the bulk of the work here and the bulk of the information with which to make these decisions was within the department. But there was a failure by the scrutiny committee at the Assembly. There was a failure by the Assembly as a whole to question this more. And one of the things that I wonder is whether, if there had been an opposition at Stormont, there would have been opposition parties who, because of the selfish nature of trying to get one over the executive, would actually have been incentivised to really ask the difficult questions. At this point, there was almost a sense at times whereby they were all in the government together, with the exception of a handful of MLAs, and there was almost a sense sometimes of, you don't ask too difficult questions of my minister and I don't ask too difficult questions of your minister. It wasn't always like that, but there was a sense like that at various points. This was a joint programme for government commitment. All of the parties had signed up to it. Why would they ask difficult questions about it?
Tell you what, Sam, I doubt Sir Patrick Coughlin would be a Nolan Show fan. That's just my gut instinct. But boy, is he forensic. And boy, is he across his brief. I'm sitting watching this inquiry every day, and sometimes he's actually helping the barristers with detail. He's across every single fact of this.
Well, I think not only has he been very impressive in some of his questioning and the barristers, but I think that the two panel members have been very impressive, because you've got a barrister and a judge who have legal minds. They're asking questions from a particular point of view. You've then got Dame Una O'Brien, who was the former Permanent Secretary of Whitehall's Department of Health, so she understands the civil service system, and she's asking very specific questions about how things ought to operate there. And then, as we heard earlier, Dr. Keith McLean, who is an energy expert, who's across the figures, who understands how boilers operate, the nature of kilowatt hours, and all of that very detailed technical information. And what you're seeing is really each witness facing different questions from each of those people from different perspectives. But that I think is much more successful at teasing out the truth than, for instance, coming before a committee of MLAs at Stormont or something of that nature. There's just nothing like, and it's not the fault of MLAs, they don't have that nature of expertise, but what we're seeing here is a turning over of the stones at Stormont in a way that has never happened before, I think, in the history of Northern Ireland.
What I would urge you all to do as you're listening to this programme this morning is go to the BBC News website where you can learn about everything that has unfolded in the RHI inquiry so far. So that's on the BBC News website. And maybe, Sam, finally, you could just sum up, because it would be wrong just to focus on the testimony of Dr. Crawford and indeed testimony about Arlene Foster. What's the wider picture that we've got in this inquiry so far?
The wider picture is of a civil service which lacks the expertise and lacks the application in some cases to properly scrutinise policy. We have a picture of a minister and a special advisor who are exceptionally reliant on and, as we said, trusting of their officials. And we have a wider Stormont system which is not or was not at this point operating in a way that was able to scrutinise what was, with hindsight, a very obvious series of flaws in this policy, but at the time it sealed through the entire system with no one out of really scores of people asking any of the pertinent questions.
OK, Sam McBride from the newsletter, thank you very much indeed. Teresa, morning Teresa.
Morning Stephen.
Go ahead.
Listening to your topic this morning, my question is, was the First Minister qualified for the position she was in? Was she a figurehead only and solely dependent on her special advisers?
Well, why do you say that?
Well, in any other workplace, in any other organisation, you must be qualified for the position you hold and your 100% responsibility.
Well, Arlene Foster has decades of political experience and is a lawyer by background.
Yes, she may be a lawyer by background and is qualified in law. Is she qualified in medicine? Is she qualified in government departments?
What she did see, what was on one of the papers that she saw, was a statement from some of the officials saying that the RHI scheme would provide the highest heat output at best value, right? So let me just ask you this, Teresa, as a member of the public. With that statement, would that allow you to sign on behalf of 1.5 million people throughout Northern Ireland, I am satisfied that the benefits justify the costs, if you didn't know what the costs were?
No, certainly not. You're dealing with taxpayers' money.
Arlene Foster says she doesn't bear any personal responsibility.
Oh, yes, you are 100% responsible.
That was a general statement
you hold.
She, in other words, personal responsibility. She doesn't think anything that she did personally was wrong.
Well, my question goes back to, are you qualified for the position you hold?
Teresa, thank you. Mervyn, morning Mervyn.
This man, Dr. Crawford, he doesn't seem to be any means someone who would just say something off the top of his head. Surely for him to say that the civil servants, senior civil servants, in other words, pulled the wheel over Arlene Foster's eyes, surely he must have evidence for that. Surely, if he's able to say on a public inquiry that yes, they misled Arlene Foster, where is
deliberately
his
the key word there, Mervyn, is deliberately. So he is saying that someone went out to deliberately mislead Arlene Foster. That's a massive claim.
Absolutely, Stephen. That's an incredible statement. But surely, at the end of the day, he knows someone is going to say to him in the future, where is the evidence for that? Who was it this misled her? Where did it start? Where did it end? It's serious. This is really, really serious stuff here in our wee country. And I have to tell you the truth, Steve, I have no confidence in any of them. Direct rule in the morning, as far as I'm concerned.
Why do you say that?
I'm just completely and utterly sick of it all. I voted DUP most of my adult life when I had a vote. I'm not ashamed of saying that. But this with regard to other MLAs getting money, your man Newton getting a party.
Well, hold on. Let's focus on today, because he's not here to defend himself.
What is the point of coming on the phone if you're going to tell me what I can say and cannot say.
I just want to be fair to all
minute,
different
Stephen.
Parties.
I am simply saying to you, there's every possibility that an MLA from the DUP is getting money for a job that doesn't exist. What is wrong with that? That's called the truth. That's what's wrong with Northern Ireland. Nobody wants to talk the
well,
truth.
Well, an MLA's job does exist. They're still doing constituency business.
An MLA's job exists.
Let's focus on this story, Mervyn. Let's focus on this story. What is your gut telling you about what you're hearing from the inquiry so far?
Well, the gut feeling tells me something seriously, seriously wrong. And it's bad. And we're all getting told lies. So I would suggest that it's time that we all got together. See, can I just say this? Unionism in general, Stephen's going nowhere. Unionism, it's not even treading water. It's deeply divided, deeply opinionated, and going nowhere. So my suggestion is to go away, they have a good long hard talk to themselves, all of them, Robin Swan, Arlene Foster, Nigel Dodds, and see where they can go, because at the minute Sinn Féin is wiping the floor with them. And I hate to say it, but it's the truth.
Well, you used the word lie there, and there is no basis, there is no foundation for that statement, because what is coming out from this inquiry and what the inquiry are doing a very good job in doing is establishing the truth, of course. And boy, for anybody that wondered what a public inquiry can achieve, just look at the facts that are being put into the public domain now by Sir Patrick Coughlin and his team. Stephen and Derry. Morning, Stephen.
Morning, Stephen.
Go ahead.
You know, I followed the story from the beginning and you know, in some of the outlets and yourselves, they covered it extensively. And one of the criticisms was at the time that that was not enough to bring down the government of Northern Ireland.
Well, what was being said at the time was that people like me were whipping this story up beyond what it was. There was significant criticism of people like me and Sam McBride that we were out to get people, that this wasn't as bad as what the media was portraying it to be, that the headlines were exaggerated. That's what was said at the time of RHI. It's still being said.
Yeah, I get that, Stephen, but what I'm going to say is, was bringing down of Stormont justified whenever we hear now the revelations that are coming out on a daily basis from Sam and from yourselves? You know, these are doing a great job and Sam's doing an excellent job, but what I would say is, has the decision been justified now to bring down the government and to expose some of the goings-on that is going on in our government? You know, because I feel also the same as Mervyn, that we're going nowhere. We're actually going nowhere. And what we're doing is we're getting deeper and deeper into a crisis that I can't see any way out of at the moment.
So Sinn Féin and all of the other political parties, okay, Ulster Unionist, Alliance, SDLP and so it goes on, they would have been on those scrutiny committees that who also didn't ask the question, how much is this costing?
Well, I hope
How did this get through? How did this get past everybody? How does that happen? I keep on telling you, you go to buy something for your family home, what do you ask? How much does it cost? We'll take one more call on this. Tony and Drumquin. Morning, Tony. Then we'll move on. Morning, Tony.
Hello, Stephen. How are you doing?
Good morning.
I think I'm a bit like your last two callers, Stephen. I'm coming from a point of frustration, and yourself and Sam have ended up on the firing line. I have to get some stuff off my chest.
Wouldn't a Nolan show without me getting criticised, but carry on.
As I said to your researcher, well, not criticising, I'm frustrated, Stephen, and when people get frustrated, we end up having to pick out on somebody, and as I say, yourself and Sam have ended up on the fire line. But the question I want to ask is, I am of the opinion, I travel a lot through Fermanagh and through Ireland's constituency, and I'm friendly with our voters, and I'm sure you know we have an election here now in West Tyrone where Tom Buchanan, who is
Let's not get into an election at the moment.
All right,
let's stick with this story.
Sorry. But the point I want to make is and I know I'm a bit like your last two callers, is Arlene would be re-elected again tomorrow if she stood. So what is the point of all this? If the people of Fermanagh, South Tyrone, who are the people who can come out at the end of the day and hire or fire Arlene, are going to keep her in office, then why are we going on with this crusade? What, you know, if the people are saying we're happy enough with these standards, we will re-elect her. And I know from talking to her grassroots
the only time that they will consider getting rid of Arlene, if she ever hints in any way to United Ireland, she'll be gone quicker than you can say, Arlene, but everything else, she gets the green light.
Well, you talk about a crusade. I'll just make this final point to you, Tony. The function of the Nolan Show is not to attempt, nor would we ever attempt, to get someone hired or fired. It's not what we do. What we're trying to do here is give all of you as much information as possible. And those the public inquiry, the RHI public inquiry at the moment, you know, they last hours and hours and hours of testimony. And what the public service function that we're trying to do is we're trying to sum up to you all some of the key points from that inquiry so that you can all make your mind up, all right, either way, about everybody that is talked about within that inquiry. And that's it. What we're trying to do. Are you surprised, Tony, by some of the evidence that's coming out?
Well, I've been busy this last while and I just haven't got following it intensely as I had been over the last while. But yes, I am, Stephen. But again, what won't surprise me at the end of the day, and I know you're going to slap me across the knuckles for this, Stephen, is when it's all over, done and dusted, what we, the taxpayers, and despite all your wonderful efforts and others, is what we will know at the end of the day is just how much the inquiry costs. Because at the end of the day, it will be the same as many here in the past. There will be nobody held to account and there will be no responsibility, and people will go on as usual. And that seems to be the way it is here, and that's what we as a people now have to come to accept.
Tony, thank you. Morning.
There are no standards.
Morning to you.